Have I done her? Thank you very much. On your behalf, on the behalf of the audience, I'd like to express our gratitude for the talk, the enlightening talk that you've given us this morning. And before we move ahead with our proceedings, I'd like to open up the floor if there are any questions. I'd like to repeat that if you have a question, if you wouldn't mind coming forward, speaking into the mic so that that could be recorded and that everybody could hear the question. I'm going to start off, Rabbi, if I may, with a question of my own. And that is a simple one. What was it that led you to this research? What was it that interested you in the life of Rabbi Shapochnik, and how did you find out? Thank you.
Thank you. Several years ago, a book was published in London describing the Hasidic community of London. And there was one chapter entitled Controversial Rebbes. And there was a short biographical essay on Rabbi Shapochnik, and I interviewed the author, discovered a little bit more about him. I'm talking about 1997, and subsequently completely forgot about Rabbi Shapochnik. I am a book collector, though, and one day a book dealer offered me this massive volume of Talmud. I say massive, it's this big, this wide, it's 20 inches high and 15 inches wide. It's absolutely enormous. And I said, what is it? And he said, oh, it's published in London by Rabbi Shapochnik. It just kind of triggered an interest in me as to why some obscure London rabbi would publish a Talmud of such enormity and the industry that went into putting it together. He was a rogue, but he was a man before his time, a man with a social conscience, and a man who understood that you had to give Torah to the masses. It wasn't an elite subject. And his Talmud is, for its time, no different than maybe a Steinsaltz Gemara or an Art Scroll Gemara that we all accept today as a necessity, but in those days was something which was frowned upon. And thus the interest in him developed. And once an interest develops, you know, it's, I don't know if you've ever heard of the Zulu factor. You come from South Africa. There was a lady who moved to South Africa with her husband. I forget their names. Her husband was a banker. She had nothing to do. So she decided to go and discover more about the Zulu tribe. And she became one of the world's leading experts in Zulu culture and art. Her husband wrote a book called The Zulu Factor, saying that it's the speciality of any one person's knowledge in a particular sphere which allows them to excel and to stand out in that sphere and to make a living. He was talking about banking, but he used his wife's knowledge of Zulu culture as the example. So I am the example of the world expert on the most obscure rabbi from England.
Earlier about the case of the rabbi's mentor and teacher, who
yes.
You said you might touch upon in question period.
Could sure, Sarah Genner case. There were several of these cases in the late 19th century. Yeah, if people didn't hear the question, I mentioned at the very beginning of my talk the Sarah Genner Aguna case, which became a cause célèbre in Odessa during the 1880s. And one which attracted the attention of the leading halachic authorities of the day. The case was not dissimilar to what Shapochnik dealt with later. There was a lady who was married called Sarah Genner. Her husband died, and her husband's brothers, two of them, were Orthodox Christians, whatever, Russian Orthodox Christians. There was a chief rabbi of Odessa. Well, the government-appointed rabbi, his name was Schwabacher. He wasn't a big Talmud Chochem. He was an enlightened German rabbi who was approached by this Genner to see, because of his relationship with the Archbishop of Odessa, as to whether he could have asked the Archbishop to ask this former Jew, converted to Orthodoxy, as to whether that he could give the chalitza to this Sarah Gemma. And the Archbishop said that it goes against the Christian Orthodox faith to take part in any type of non-Christian Orthodox ritual, and forbade this brother from giving chalitza. So effectively, she couldn't remarry. She was naguna forever, because this brother was never going to give chalitza, and he was a Christian Orthodox man, and that was it. And Dayan Abelson had recently moved to Odessa, and he came up with this concept that a mummer, somebody who is a denier of God and a heretic, and being Christian Orthodox and not willing to participate in any kind of Jewish thing, would make somebody that. She doesn't need chalitza from him, and she could remarry. That's the sort of basic story. The nuts and bolts are obviously more complicated. There was other Dayanim in Odessa who were not as big Talmidei Chachomim as Dayan Abelson, who opposed him for this and reported him to the leading rabbis of the day, including Rabbi Yitzchok Yochanan Spekter and the Beis Halevi, Rabbi Yosef Dov Ber Soloveitchik, and others, and said that this dispensation was spurious, and he had aligned himself with this government-appointed rabbi against the so-called Haredi element of the community. And of course, there's echoes of all these things that I've been discussing today, and in all the arguments that we see in today's community. But ultimately, Abelson's dispensation was supported, and I have those publications, which Abelson produced, one in 1885 and one in 1887, in which his dispensations were completely and utterly supported by the leading halachic authorities of the day. I suspect, though, that the reason why they were supported is because the facts of the case were so clear. It was clearly true that this Sarah Genna's brother-in-law was a mummer, and it was clearly true that she was naguna, and all these facts were very evident. Whereas in Shapochnik's cases that he produced in Likur L'Asur in Dror, the facts of these stories were proven to be much more grey area. So he would say things about the women or about their brothers-in-law which weren't entirely true, but for the sake of the dispensation, he put them forward. I think that is really it. Thank you.
Before I ask a question, I can just say a comment on this most fascinating and interesting series of facts. The Rabbi Yidel Rosenberg you mentioned was the rabbi of this shul.
Really?
When this shul was still downtown, before it amalgamated with a small synagogue in this area, and the Oron HaKodesh was brought from the original synagogue downtown and is still here. I might mention also that your reference to the rule in England that only the chief rabbi can be called rabbi and everybody else has to be called reverend, that was implemented by the second chief rabbi Adler, and after he died in 1911, it was that rule was no longer implemented. My question is, you mentioned Rabbi Shapochnik was, they refused to bury him. So finally, in which cemetery was he buried?
He's buried in Enfield Cemetery.
Oh, that's the Adas. Yeah.
The Adas Cemetery, and the dispensation for that was given by Rabbi Solomon Schoenfeld, who was who had recently become the head rabbi of the Adas, and who felt that Shapochnik was a mace mitzvah, and that despite any of the activities he may have carried out in his life, he was worthy of a Jewish burial. And in fact, the Jewish Chronicle, the main Jewish newspaper of England, that time and then and now, commented on how disgraceful it was for an argument to be carried even beyond somebody's death. And both the United Synagogue and the Federation of Synagogues refused to bury Rabbi Shapochnik on the basis that he was an unacceptable person. But the Adas, which was so-called the Frumma community, the Haredi community, were willing to bury him on the basis that it was a mace mitzvah, regardless of who he was and what he may have done.
And Rabbi Solomon Schoenfeld's father, Avigdor Schoenfeld, is also buried in that cemetery.
Correct. That's right. As are many great rabbis, the Shotzer Rebbe is buried there, and various other very prominent rabbis are buried in that basic forest. Yes.
Thank you.
I couldn't have asked for a better cue, because I'm currently writing the definitive biography of Joseph Chopochnik, and in fact I've brought with me some leaflets here, preliminary announcements of the book, which is called Rebel Rabbi: The Life and Controversies of Joseph Chopochnik, which, if you want to give out to people who are interested. Yeah, but I couldn't be so brash and American and promote my book, but seeing as you cued me in that way, I'm very pleased to be able to do so. Thank you. Yes, the question was, to what extent were any of the halachic arguments used by Rabbi Chopochnik usable in an objective sense, once you strip away all the subjective nonsense about the way he behaved and the way people opposed him? The answer to that is probably a guarded yes. The man was a genius. There's no question about it. He's an industrious man. He had tremendous knowledge. He was superficial, I suspect, because he never devoted enough energy and attention to the academic side of what he was doing. He was so interested in the practical side. Having said that, I think that whatever the merits of the halachic cases that he made, they were offset by his emotional involvement in the cases themselves. He wasn't writing a halachic manual. He was driven totally by the emotions of the social needs of the time. I'm not saying that that's a bad thing, it's a very good thing. But he was 100% emotion, well, let's say 90% emotion and 10% halakha. And I think in situations like that, it's probably advisable. And that's probably why you need kind of across the board agreement on issues like this, because there's such an emotional element to the issue of Aguna, and the other things he dealt with, which I haven't delved into because it just wasn't time. He did deal with other issues as well, which were very troubling in the Jewish community. And but there's no question about it that if you read his books, you can't just discard them as nonsense. Yes, he was a very charismatic man. He was tall, with a big red beard. He looked like a Hasidic Rebbe. He wore long silken bekesha and a big fur hat, even during the week. And he was a good speaker, very eloquent, a very friendly man. He was subject to outbursts of temper, but generally speaking, he was very good-natured. And I met his grandchildren in the East End of London. They still live there. One of them is a minyan man in one of the last shuls of the East End. And they recall him as a wonderful grandfather and a very nice man. I've met other people who remember him and remember him as a wonderful human being. So notwithstanding any of the things I may have said about him today, that's the human element, that's the human side of a lot of the controversies that we read. Whether they be about anybody in the Jewish world and the non-Jewish world, there's always a human being there, father, grandfather, an uncle, a cousin, who's a member of a family and somebody who's loved by that family.
Thank you very much, Rabbi Dunner. And ladies and gentlemen, as I said earlier, I'd like to thank you very much for being here this morning. Rabbi Dunner did mention that it's the early session. In spite of that, I think if we look around the hall and around our beautiful shul this morning, we should each take away something very special from the talk. Not only that we've learnt about a rabbi who, as Rabbi Dunner said, preceded his time, but perhaps more importantly, that spirit of questioning lives on in each one of us this morning. It takes a certain amount of effort to reschedule one's day so that all of us could be here this morning, and I think that as we leave, some of that humanity that Rabbi Dunner spoke about through Rabbi Chopochnik continues with us and our learning today. So thank you very much for coming. I hope you enjoy the rest of the day, and once again I'd like to thank Rabbi Dunner for his talk. Thank you.
Thank you.